Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Stephen King Cast, one man's musings on the works of Stephen King. Each week, I'll review one entry in the bibliography of Stephen King in the chronological order of publication. And this week, guys, I'm not really talking about Stephen King, not directly anyway, but I feel as though I would be doing a disservice if I didn't talk about Netflix's Stranger Things. So for those of you who have not watched Stephen King's and you're listening to something called the Stephen King Cast, you should not listen to the rest of this episode. You should stop what you're doing right now. Run to your television or your tablet or your laptop and just start binging on Stranger Things. Seriously, guys, you will not be disappointed. So I'm going to get into a lot of Stranger Things talk and just share my love for this summer's bit of pop culture that everyone is talking about right now. In the meantime, I want to shamelessly plug my own stuff. So for those of you who are listening and have been listening for a while, you might know that I have been fortunate enough to have had some short stories of my own published, and I'm gonna just list off some places where you can get these short stories, the first of which was Room 207, which was published in the pages of Dark Moon Digest, issue number 22. You can find that on Amazon. You can either download it to your Kindle, or you can order a physical copy. Up next, we have This World Will Eat You All the Way Up, which was found in Nine Tales Told in the Dark, issue number 9. Again, you can get that from Amazon. Well, you can get all of these from Amazon. And then we have Hopscotch, which is found in the Wax and Wane, a Gathering of Witch Tales anthology. Then we have, coming up this August, we have a short story entitled Forget Me Not, which will be found in the Trysts of Fate magazine. And then lastly, my short story, The Portrait, was picked up for the anthology Skeptics Must Die. So if you have been interested in any of my short stories, head on over to any of these publications. I know that the publishers would just be happy to get another purchase. So head on over to Amazon and pick up any one of those. So up next, what I'm going to do, I'm going to read some emails, some listener emails. As you know, I love getting emails from everyone. You can write in at stephenkingcast@yahoo.com. Up first, we have Tina, who writes, "Hello. First of all, I would love to know your name unless you are keeping it a secret. I still am enjoying your podcast very much. For all intents and purposes, my name for the show is Constant Reader. My pseudonym for my short stories is Cooper O'Connor." Tina continues, "Finished listening to your analysis of It. I read the book in college. It took me all summer to read it. It's so different from the miniseries. I love the miniseries. Whenever I watch It, LOL, I always turn on the commentary with the actors and Tommy Lee Wallace. The actors were John Ritter, Richard Thomas, Tim Reed, and Dennis Christopher. I think Richard Thomas and Tommy Lee were recorded separately. The other three are funny when they talk about the movie. Tim Curry was awesome as Pennywise. It'll be very difficult to fill those clown shoes. John Ritter was so cool to listen to since he was also a big Stephen King fan. He talks about his experiences about Stephen King. I thought it was funny how you mentioned Idris Elba as a rumor for Mike." So I just want to stop in my review of the It miniseries, or one of the reviews for It. I did a three-part It review. At some point, I talked about just kind of fan casting for the movie, and this was long before the movie started, you know, really, really gearing up where it's filming right now. This is when it was still, you know, being talked about, and I had talked about just fan casting, and I listed off some fan casting sites where just fans were casting, and Idris Elba's name got floated for Mike. So I just want to clarify that this was not a rumor. It was just fan casting. So anyway, Tina continues, "I thought it was funny how you mentioned Idris Elba as a rumor for Mike. Now he's slated to play Roland. Do you think they would bring any of the older actors back from the miniseries for just cameo purposes? I know that they wouldn't be able to bring back John Ritter or Tim Curry, but it would be interesting to see what they decide to do. I finally finished The Wind Through the Keyhole. That was interesting. I listened to Thinner. That was a creepy movie. They filmed part of it in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I remember hearing about it when I went to Portsmouth High School. I loved hearing you play Weird Al at the beginning. Great choice. I love your music choices. I've noticed that Stephen King adds music into his writing. I'm looking forward to hearing your take on The Stand. Loved how they played Don't Fear the Reaper at the beginning. Just sets the tone. Looking forward to listening to more. All the best. Tina." P.S. Before signing off, and this is a spoiler, guys, from spoiler for the Dark Tower Book 7, The Dark Tower. So if you haven't finished the Dark Tower series, don't listen to this part. So before signing off, I also wondered if the spider from It was Dandelo from the Dark Tower. There are so many connections, and I love hearing about them and reading about them. So Tina, no, the answer is no. I know that some people have, you know, speculated that that is the case. It's not. I mean, Stephen King himself has said that it's not. He said that they might be related in some way, but from the author's point of view, that these are two separate characters. I do talk about the similarities and sort of how to explain those similarities from a larger perspective in, I believe, in my bonus episode of my It reviews. There was a three-part It review, plus there was a bonus episode, I believe, called The Spider and the Turtle. And I kind of connect it to the larger Dark Tower mythos. So I look at on what Dandelo might mean and why we see a spider in It and a clown in It and this clownish spider vampire figure in the pages of the Dark Tower and really what that means. So Tina, if you're interested in my thoughts on that, head on over to that particular episode, The Spider and the Turtle. Okay, up next we have Aaron, who writes, "Hello. First, let me thank you for your wonderful podcast. I just discovered it last week and have been working my way through the old shows. I've just finished the Revival review and just started the Gunslinger show. I've really been enjoying the show and listened to at least one episode at work each night. I first started reading Stephen King in the very early 80s. I was 10 in 1982, and I was able to read everything as it came out after, let's say, Firestarter, as long as the library could get it for me. My dad was blind, and so absorbed a lot of King, along with a lot of Mickey Spillane, Louis L'Amour, and Raymond Chandler by listening to Dad's tapes and records from the National Library Service for the Blind's Talking Book Program. Mom and Dad are gone now, but I still have more of a good book and for King. So thank you for bringing an old man now in his 40s some very fond memories. As someone who is almost as big a fan of Lovecraft and his Cthulhu mythos as I am of King, I was glad to see you caught mention of the De Vermis Mysterious in Night Shift and Revival. This terrible tome, however, isn't an invention of Mr. King. It's something he borrowed from psycho author Robert Bloch. Bloch was an original member of the Lovecraft Circle, a group of young writers who were inspired by and corresponded with Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft encouraged his friends to make up their own additions to his mythos, and most of the fledgling authors contributed to their now ancient gods and their own blasphemous books to sit alongside Lovecraft's Necronomicon. Clark Ashton Smith created the Book of Iban. Conan author Robert E. Howard gave us, I can't pronounce that, but it's translated to Nameless Cults. And Robert Bloch contributed The Mysteries of the Worm. In fact, a collection of all of Bloch's mythos work, excluding the novel Strange Eons, has recently been released under the same name. I see that you're not going to cover Danse Macabre. Why, I can totally understand why you wouldn't. I wish maybe you would reconsider talking about it now that you are caught up with King's current books. I ask this, of course, for purely selfish reasons. I would have to say that Danse Macabre might be the most important book I've ever read. Through that book, Stephen King, ever the teacher, was able to introduce little preteen me to most of the authors that I enjoy today. Without Danse Macabre, I might never have heard of Lovecraft, Howard, Bradbury, Shirley Jackson, Ira Levin, Richard Matheson, James Herbert, Ramsey Campbell, Fritz Lieber, and even John Saul, who he doesn't really have anything good to say about. Yes, Danse Macabre was a very pivotal book in my literary department. Well, I've rambled enough. I'll let you go. I'm looking forward to listening to more of this great show. I haven't gotten to your coverage of the Bill Hodges books yet, but as I enjoyed them, it might be the first time we have wildly differing opinions on something. I did enjoy Cujo more than you, though. Then again, I was like 11, so. Have a great day, Aaron. Aaron, thank you for writing in. Thanks for the clarification on the Mysteries of the Worm. I never would have known that, so I think that is... That's awesome. Okay, so guys, like I said, if you have any thoughts that you want to share, head on over to StephenKingCast@yahoo.com. I know that I'm not recording with the same frequency that I was when I was reviewing the books each week. But still, I mean, if you write in and you know, you don't mind me sharing, I'll definitely share your thoughts online so everyone can hear. Okay, guys, so here we go. I just want to talk about Stranger Things. So, spoilers on. If you've been curious about Stranger Things, I'm really gonna spoil it. So I strongly encourage you guys to head on out and watch Stranger Things. All 8 episodes are available on Netflix. I'm telling you, I mean, there are some things hit at the right time. This hit at the right time. It's such a great summer show. It doesn't necessarily take place in the summer. It takes place in November. But there's something summery about this at the same time that I think is just, it's just perfect. It's a perfect show to watch. And it's something that first crossed my radar a few months back when the first teaser trailer came out, and I don't think that anyone really was aware of it. And, you know, a lot of people started talking about the Spielbergian aspects of it and how it seems to be a throwback to 80s. And I was like, oh, that's very interesting. And then the second trailer hit, and, you know, it really looked cool. And then so I started saying, all right, so July, whatever the date was, maybe the 19th, July 19th, when that comes out, I'm very, very, very interested. And then some buzz started to build around it, and the opening credits was released online and what that would look like. And it's the opening credits that opened this episode, and how the Duffer brothers, the creative force behind Stranger Things, started talking about their inspirations, how the music throughout was going to have a very John Carpenter feel to it, and the Stranger Things font for the logo was going to invoke early 80s Stephen King novels, and how the tone and the story was going to, you know, be a seeped in Stephen King narrative and Spielbergian influences. So right there, I said, this is awesome. That's a really cool way of going about it. So, I mean, I am the kind of person that this is being made for, right? So I was more inclined to want to like it, but guys, I didn't think I was gonna like it this much. I mean, I just love it. I love it. I love Stranger Things. I was tweeting about it that weekend when it came out, and one of the tweets that I said I have never seen a more perfect execution of an author's intent. I mean, you can see exactly what the Duffer brothers are doing when they're telling this story, and they are in such control of their craft that everything that you see them attempting to do, they're really doing it. They're executing it. They're sticking the landing. And I'm just talking about the end of the show, but they're sticking the landing with every choice that they're making. Guys, it's just awesome, you know, and this isn't really going to be a review. It's just going to be me saying the show is awesome for the next 5 minutes or so. One thing that has kind of just been, I don't know, I mean, there's been a lot of sites that are kind of posting the references. Oh, spot the references to the, or the homages to the 80s sources of inspiration. And I've seen a lot of, sites, you know, kind of criticizing the 80s aesthetic and the choice to set it in the 80s. But I don't know. To me, it's a very cynical look to look at this show, which is set in 1983, and then dismiss it as purely nostalgia or nostalgia porn, as some people have put it. That to me is just really taking away what the Duffer brothers have been able to do, and what they've been able to do is just phenomenal. I think that the 80s look of it, makes it a little bit more special, especially for those of us who, you know, grew up in the 80s. But, I mean, it's not the end-all, be-all. You know, I feel like, and I'm not the first person to say this, but, I mean, this is what Super 8 wanted to be. And I have problems with Super 8. I enjoy Super 8, but I see the difference between Super 8 and this is, whereas I said with Stranger Things, you can see what the creators are doing, and you see them executing it perfectly. I saw what J.J. Abrams was doing, but he wasn't executing what he set out to do, I don't think. So to me, the '80s, it makes it work. But I don't think that I don't think it's a gimmick the way that I think that some sites or some critics are kind of painting it as, because the '80s is recreated, I think, wonderfully. I think it's done very, very well. The Duffer Brothers, I think, are 32. So they certainly were not, they weren't around like this in 1983. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an authenticity of the 80s. I think that there's a look there, and a lived-in feel. It's not superficial, and it's not spot the 80s references. I mean, there's a lot of music that they use from the 80s, and I mean, you'll see 80s homages, you know, on the wall, like The Thing. There's a poster for The Thing, and you know. But I don't think it's distracting, and I don't think it was the main purpose of that particular scene. You know, I don't think it was, the scenes are built around the music. I don't think the scenes are built around the poster on the wall. I mean, that to me, that's superficial dressing on what is a very rich story that they're being told. You know, I mean, and if you're into that thing, you know, I mean, if you're into the, you know, spot the Easter egg, spot the references, then you're gonna have a good time. But to me, those are just markers that indicate the setting, so that, you know, the setting's firmly established. But for me, this was right up my alley. And as a parent in his 30s, the three storylines that are occurring in this eight episodes, I can relate to all of them, and it's great. So Winona Ryder's character Joyce, I can tap into her storyline being a parent. The Nancy and the Jonathan storyline, I can tap into that because I was that age at one point. And then the boys storyline, you know, boys and bikes, that is just a subgenre that I lived myself. So, I mean, there wasn't a story. I mean, and I also was a government agent working on, you know, experimental Cold War spying techniques. So, I mean, there isn't a storyline that I can't tap into. So, I mean, that was just a little bit of a extra bonus for me personally. But I want to take a few moments, and I want to talk about the Kingisms that I found. So after I just said that I don't like spotting the Easter eggs, I'm going to talk about a bunch of the Easter eggs. But I mean, I from a very organic standpoint, I'm just looking at the ingredients. I'm not nitpicking the final product necessarily. I'm just looking at how it was made and what I could spot. You know, for me to criticize the inspirations here, if I were to criticize the inspirations of 80s movies and Stephen King books, then I can never watch, I can't allow myself to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Because Spielberg and Lucas, they were purposefully trying to tell a story inspired by the classic serials that they had watched when they were growing up. And Stephen King, I mean, I guess I can never read It because It is inspired by a lot of the 50s horror movies and that he had when he was growing up. So I mean, we wear our inspirations on our sleeve, and they help inform us who we are as storytellers. So I'm not dismissing the 80s aesthetic, and I'm not dismissing their inspirations, but I never at one point felt as though the inspirations were getting in the way of this original narrative. So there's been a lot of talk of how this is a these eight episodes is a blend of King and Spielberg's sensibilities. And I think that I said this on a previous episode, but I think it's probably the greatest missed opportunity that Spielberg never directed one of King's books, because I think that Spielberg is the Stephen King of movies. So, I mean, there's definitely some a Venn diagram between these two, where they're, that middle between the two circles is pretty, there's some pretty rich overlapping there. And I think that Steven Spielberg would have been able to make a fantastic Stephen King adaptation. Thankfully for us, we get this, the Duffer brothers, who were able to create Stranger Things, and you can see those inspirations. And a lot of people are talking how it's leaning towards Spielberg, and maybe it's just because I've been looking at Stephen King so closely for so long, but I definitely see the Stephen King aspect more so than the Amblin quality, although there are some really key moments there that are just straight out of, you know mid-80s Amblin films. But I mean, it has a real lived-in quality. I mean, these houses feel lived in. These relationships feel real. I mean, and that it has that classic Steven Spielberg technique of just kind of messy life, and how people are just talking over each other, and there's just a naturalism there to it. So it's just the Duffer Brothers were just able to create a setting filled with characters that you just want to spend time with. And I think that plays to the strength of both King and Spielberg. But specifically with with King, I mean, we're talking, I mean, you watch this movie and you meet the kids, who are Mike and Lucas and Dustin and Will. And then Will goes missing, and then 11 comes in. But I mean, you see these kids and immediately you're going to think, oh, these are the losers, or the kids from Stand By Me. I mean, a lot of people are, yeah, I guess it's kind of interchangeable, but they definitely have a loser's vibe, because the losers specifically go hunting for a monster, right? And that's what these kids are doing. And the Stand By Me crew, there was a lot more kind of just musing about life and where they were in life and trying to get past death. And actually, there is some of that. And so it's definitely a... It's splitting hairs, but I mean, because as I've always said, the kids in Stand By Me, those were just prototypes for the Losers Club in It. And a lot of people are talking about the Goonies. I don't know, guys. Maybe it's because I don't like the Goonies that much, but it's not that I see the Goonies. I see these being King kids. And the kid that plays Mike is going to be playing Eddie. No, not Eddie. Richie in the It adaptation. Finn Wolfhard is his name, who has the most badass name on the show. So we'll see Finn Wolfhard soon enough. And I'm excited because he was awesome. All of these kids are awesome. These kids are great. Whoever casted this across the board did a phenomenal job, especially with these kids. It's not always easy to get kid actors, but they're great. So if you are a fan of It or The Body, Stand By Me, and there's definitely a shout out there to The Body. There's an episode title. It's called like Chapter 4 or 5, and it's entitled The Body. And guys, the opening credits, I'm sorry I'm all over the place, but the opening credits are so cool. Like that theme song is so good, and just the reveal of, the title Stranger Things, and then when it lights up and it fades back, and then the chapter title comes up and it comes on the screen. It's just, when that happened on the first episode, I mean, that was just the opening with the boys, I mean, and the monster and the everything, and then Will, everything that happened, and then the light bulb goes out, and then the music hits. I mean, I was just slack-jawed. I was teary-eyed because it just hit me, and it there was such confidence in that. And I said to myself, "This is gonna do it. This is going to fill all of the needs that I want out of this type of story." And I didn't realize how badly I wanted it. But going back to the sort of It aspects of it, I mean, as we know in It, Bev had a slingshot, and that was very, very important. We got a wrist rocket here, which to me feels just very, very loser-ish. I mean, and then going back to the Stand By Me kids, they definitely walk along train tracks at one point, which just really invokes the Stand By Me. Just the famous train tracks from Stand By Me. I mean, and then, when the bullies show up, there's bullies in here. Bully played by, not played by, but the bully's name is Troy, also, which is just great 80s specificity. I don't think that you're going... I mean, you don't see kids named Troy now. In 2016, you don't see someone walking around with the name of Troy being that age. That was a very specific to the 80s name. So, I mean, just to have that kid named Troy, just that was awesome. Awesome authenticity. But, I mean, at one point, like I said, spoilers on, guys. Just spoilers on for the entire thing. But, I mean, he whips out a switchblade. And that, to me, just is so Henry Bowers. I mean, having a bully whip out a knife, I mean, that doesn't happen in real life. That is very specific to Stephen King, though. That, to me, that was a very Stephen King-ish sort of moment. And let's talk about Eleven. And Eleven is great. I mean, and that is such a... Everything having to do with Eleven and her whole story, that's just so... It's Charlie McGee and the shop. And you know from my reviews of Firestarter and other reviews throughout the podcast, I've talked about how I missed the shop. There was a period there where King was writing about the shop a little bit more, kind of building the shop up. I mean, they show up, spoiler alert, in the Tommyknockers. They're referenced in The Stand. I mean, I know that he's disavowed any involvement in this, but the Lawnmower Man movie starring Jeff Fahey and Pierce Brosnan, the shop are the bad guys. So, I mean, the shop was definitely something that he was playing with there for a while. So to see this government organization, to me, I just kind of pretended that it was the shop. And I got so much enjoyment out of that. It was fantastic. So, I mean, there's the flashback scenes with Eleven being experimented on, which if you watch Firestarter, you'll definitely see the inspirations there. But from a narrative standpoint, it brought the shop to Derry, Maine, or it brought the shop to Castle Rock, however you want to look at it. Because it's the way that you want to look, the way that I described this from a Stephen King standpoint, the narrative structure here, and if you take all the Stephen King-isms and swirl them together, it's the losers teaming up with Alan Pangborn and Charlie McGee to fight the shop and the Tommyknockers. And it's awesome. It's just so cool if you look at it that way, because we have our Alan Pangborn figure, who is kind of a, you know, he's kind of like a riff between Alan Pangborn and Chief Brody, I guess you could say, from Jaws. But he definitely plays that Alan Pangborn role, and he's just awesome. David Harbour, I believe the actor's name is, and he creates Hopper to be a three-dimensional character, and he's just so good, guys. He's so good. And there's a whole thing with the Tommyknockers that feels like Altair 4, with the monster. I mean, and then even little things like Winona Ryder, at one point she becomes Judy Marshall from Black House, where there's a monster behind the wall, and she's like tearing down the walls to try and get to another dimension, which is when we meet Judy in Black House for the first time. She's trying to find her missing son. She's removed all of the posters on the wall, and she's starting to tear down the wall because she thinks that there's another world behind there. Yeah, guys, and then we get, I mean, I swear to God, there's even a Silver Bullet homage in there. I mean, there's a scene where Nancy, who has to be named after Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street, and Jonathan, they're teaming up in a hilarious scene to go monster hunting. But the way that it's lit and they're filling the trunk, I mean, that to me, and they're going to the house and waiting for the monster, that felt very Silver Bullet to me, waiting for the werewolf to show up. And so, I don't know, guys. It was just wonderful. It's just wonderful. And I'm sorry I don't have, like, much to say, because what I would say is what everyone has already said and how people feel about it. It's a great watch. It's very, very enjoyable. And if you are a Stephen King fan, you're going to get a lot out of it. And maybe at some point, like, I'll do a deeper dive, but I just kind of wanted to just rattle off a list of some things that I really, really liked about it. It's just good. And it's going to be a show that I'll watch again and again. It'll be like a background show. You know, I mean, it's basically the equivalent of the movie that that you love that whenever it comes on, you kind of have to watch it. The thing is, though, with Netflix, it's not going to just pop up on TBS. I'm going to have to actively sit there and you know, pull it up. But if I have to clean the house and I can't think of anything else to watch, I'm definitely going to put that on. That will be just the show that I like to hang out with, because I want to hang out with these kids. As you might have heard, the newest co-host of the Stephen King Cast is getting a little bit hungry, so I've been trying to distract her as much as possible while I record this. Oh, she's smiling at us, guys, right now. She's smiling. She's happy. But I think that she might need to eat, so I'm going to have to sign off now. But if you guys haven't done so already, feel free to head on over to iTunes and leave a review to the Stephen King Cast, and write in at StephenKingCast@yahoo.com. And I know that I'm supposed to do this review of Cell, but I just, like I said, Cell is not that good. And I just kind of wanted to get some thoughts on Stranger Things out there while it was still fresh. And if guys, if you have listened to this and haven't seen Stranger Things, please just go. I mean, you're not gonna regret it. It's just, it's so enjoyable, and it's fun, and it's filled with just likable characters. There isn't you like every character. And I mean, maybe not every character. I mean, there's some characters that you're supposed to not like, but I mean, there's these secondary and tertiary characters that have so much, I don't know, there's some meat to them. I mean, there's these, Hopper, the sheriff, like, he's got these two deputies that work with him, and they're kind of like in their, like, I kind of want to follow them for a day, because they're kind of like this comedic duo, not like slapstick comedy, but there's a goofiness about them that I really like. And there's a science teacher who kind of steals the show, and Matthew Modine plays the Brenner, the bad guy who, you know, kind of runs the equivalent of the shop, and he's got this kind of like right-hand man, well, woman, who is just steely-eyed and just scary, and I want to know more about her. And everyone on the show, I mean, Winona Ryder is great. I mean, everyone on the show is just fantastic. You're going to fall in love with these characters. I know that I did, and that's why I'm going to watch the show again and again and again and again. All right, guys, so thanks for tuning in today. I know this was a pretty short episode, and I was just kind of like rambling on. But definitely do yourselves a favor. Go on over to Netflix and just block out 8 hours and just watch and enjoy Stranger Things. You will not be disappointed. And until we see each other again, may you have long days and pleasant nights. And I will see you here next time, where MOON spells Stephen King Cast.